Listen to the highly anticipated 100th episode of Tank and Jay Valentine's R&B Money Podcast with artist Chris Brown.
Even working with you from Carrie Hilson, Adonis, back in the day, I was 15, 14 doing that album. So like I said, I was in school like, okay, this is how you do it. This is how you make a song. There's a verse, a pre-chorus, and then a hook. I didn't know none of that.
You learned that over a summer, bro.
That's what it felt like.
That's what it felt like.
Listen to R&B Money on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Check the backseat. Check the backseat.
All right, come here.
Check the backseat.
Gets in your head, right? Good. Because every year, dozens of children are forgotten in the backseat of a car by a parent or caregiver. All never thought it could happen to them. But with changes in routines, distractions, or a sleeping child, it can happen to anyone. Parked cars get hot, fast, and can be deadly. So get it in your head.
Check the backseat.
A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
The biggest stars in country music will be taking the stage at our 2024 iHeart Country Festival, presented by Capital One.
iHeart Country.
Jason Aldean. Keith Urban. Jelly Roll. Old Dominion. Lady A. Riley Green. Ashley McBride. Brothers Osborne. Walker Hayes. All hosted by Bobby Bones at Austin's Moody Center. Saturday, May 4th. Stream only on Hulu. Starting at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Inside the Studio on iHeartRadio. My name's Jordan Runtog, but enough about me. My guest today is the co-founder and leader of one of the greatest horn sections on planet Earth. They've notched hits like So Very Hard to Go, You're Still a Young Man, and of course, the immortal floor filler What Is Hip. They've also backed a dizzying array of music's biggest artists, from Elton John and the Stones to Huey Lewis, Little Feat, Santana, the list goes on and on. The group celebrated half a century together with a new live album recorded in their hometown of Oakland. It's called 50 Years of Funkin' Soul, live at the Fox Theater. And now you're about to hear all sorts of tales from their incredible run, from the guy who's been there for every note of their music. I'm so happy to welcome Mr. Emilio Castillo from Tower of Power. Well, I have so many things to ask you, but I guess we'll just dive right in. You've just wrapped up a new tour with Tower of Power. It must have been so nice to get back out on the road after the last year and a half. I imagine that was probably the longest time you've been off the road in quite some years.
52 years. Never been off the road that much.
That is nuts. Oh, my goodness. I mean, how was that time at home? Did you find yourself staying sharp musically by writing? And, like, what kind of stuff did you do to keep busy?
I did. I wrote. I practiced my instrument, which I've never really been one to practice a lot.
Never needed to.
I confess that because I play all the time, you know. But I practiced my instruments and did some writing. I got married not quite a year before the pandemic. And so it was, you know, some great time to be with my new wife.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, really nice. And I was kind of in non-belief for 6 months, thinking it's going to end any day. And after 6 months, I strapped myself in and said, I'm in for the long haul, and made the best of it. And a lot of good things came out of it, but grateful to be back at work.
Yeah. What was the response like? Must have been really rapturous.
Really good for the most part. Not every single gig. We always get a good response, but some better than others. Some were really off the chain, you know. Like we just did this last weekend, five shows in Seattle at the Jazz Alley, and every one of the shows was packed, and they were just really excited, and that really makes it easy for us to do a good show.
Oh, man. I mean, speaking of live performances, you recently released a live album celebrating your 50th anniversary as a band, fittingly at the Fox Theater in Oakland. Taking it all the way back to your start, how did this all begin for you? Was there a moment when you knew that music was going to be sort of the guiding force in your life?
Well, I started playing when I was 14, and I always tell people, you know, we did it completely backwards. We didn't practice for years and years and join a band. We started a band the first day, and then we learned how to play. And I remember my buddy Jody Lopez around the corner had gotten a guitar, and he knew how to play that intro to Pretty Woman by Roy Orbison. Down, 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 down. And my brother could go bam, bam, bam on the drum. And I squeaked on the saxophone, and my mother walked in and said, they're going to be huge stars. And, you know, it's like the band just became my whole life. And very shortly after that, my father came to me and he said, you have to be the leader of the band. Now, my brother was the drummer and he's 10 months older than me. And so he was the leader. You know, we're kids, the older one's the leader. And I said, no, Jack's the leader. You know, and he goes, no. He goes, you need to be the leader because you're the one that's sort of telling everybody what to do musically, you know. And he forced me to be a leader, and that changed my life.
Now, a lot of bands in the mid-60s are heavily influenced by the Beatles and Ed Sullivan, but you were different in that, from my understanding, you were influenced by another B, Batman.
That's true. That wasn't really our idea. We liked rock and roll, you know. When we first started playing, people wore costumes. You know, there was Paul Revere and the Raiders, and in the Bay Area, there was some friends at our high school named Peter Wheat and the Breadmen. There was another band called the Dutch Masters who, you know, dressed like those Puritans on the cigar boxes.
That's amazing.
You know, there were all these bands that dressed certain ways with these costumes. And we were called the Extension Five, and we just played rock and roll. Louie Louie and, you know, Hang On Sloopy and, you know, that kind of stuff. And we had a pretty tight little band, and we all wore, you know, sharkskin matador outfits. And we went to go audition at this place that it was actually a topless bar, but on Sundays they had a teen dance. And so we went there to audition for the teen dance, and the guy there was two of them, Sidney Dopps and Jerry Ralston. I'll never forget. These guys were something else. And they came to my mother, who was the manager at the time, and they said, we have an idea. The Batman show was just coming out. And, you know, when it actually came out, it proved to be a really bogus sort of, you know, but before it came out, the buildup was huge. They had a big ad campaign. And, you know, Superman, the series, was always very popular. And now all of a sudden, here comes Batman. Everybody thought it was going to be great. Plus, it was in color, you know. So it was going to be this huge thing. And he said, we want to name your kids Batman and the Robins. We'll have your drummer dress as Batman and all the other four guys dress as Robin. We'll put a blue silk thing around the drums that looks like a bat cave, and we'll put these boxes with lights blinking, perforated plastic in front, blinking so it looks like this. You know,
a bat signal, yeah.
Yeah. These are, you know, computers, I guess. And so, you know, my mom, also quite a promoter, you know, she goes, you know, yeah, we'll do that, you know. And they said they were going to contact the TV show and say, you know, you have to have them on the show. So they did that. My mom and Rocco's mom got busy sewing, you know, outfits. And they contacted the TV show and said, you know, we're so excited about the new show that's going to premiere, you know, next month. And we really urge you to bring on the hottest rock and roll band in the business, Batman and the Robins. And they immediately got a letter that said, cease and desist immediately. And that's, it's illegal to use the name. And these guys, they didn't even miss a step. They took a step back. They went, we'll call it the Gotham City Crime Fighters. And that's what they did. And within like 2 weeks, we were playing the top places in the Bay Area as the number one act. And they billed us as, don't miss the Gotham City Crime Fighters with their $15,000 light show. Now, you got to understand, in 1965, $15,000 was like, you know, $100,000, you know. And all we really had were these boxes that we made out of plywood with this plastic and the lights blinking. But people bought it and we were mobbed. I mean, for about 3 months, we were like the biggest stars in the Bay Area. We played Longshoreman's Hall and the Bossa Go-Go at the Hotel Leamington, all over town, you know. And then, you know, it all went away. As soon as the show came out, it was bogus. You know, it was really...
Yeah, Adam West.
The whole thing blew up, you know. And we got tired of it anyway.
Oh, man. Well, aside from Batman, who were some of your other early musical influences? I mean, James Brown's Famous Flames come to mind immediately. I know you're born and raised in Detroit. I imagine there must have been a lot of soul in those early days.
Yeah, I lived in Detroit till I was 11. And my parents, they loved albums, and they played them all the time, and singles, 45s. So they had Elvis Presley, and they had Bill Doggett, Honky Tonk. They always played the Platters. They were really big fans of the Platters. My mother said, I used to sit on the toilet at 6 years old and sing Only You by the Platters verbatim. I was a really good little mimic. And they listened to Sarah Vaughan and Dinah Washington, a lot of Nat King Cole, that kind of stuff. So that's what I listened to as a young boy. Then I got out to the Bay Area, and I'm missing my friends in Detroit. And that's when all those songs started coming out of New York by Carole King and Jerry Goffin and Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, the Drifters and the Coasters and all that
the
kind
Benny
of stuff.
King
I
stuff.
I love that sound, all those Burt Bacharach songs by Dionne Warwick, I love that stuff. And then right about that time, the Motown thing hit. And of course, I'm missing my friends in Detroit. So my radio became my friend, and I just loved songs and records. And so all the Motown artists, Lil Anthony and the Imperials, certainly later on, James Brown. I remember my dad and I watching him on TV. And then one night, Wayne Cochran came on. He was like the white James Brown down in Florida. And we were watching him. He had this big 17-piece band. And, we just love that stuff. Sam and Dave, Otis Redding, really into it,
Jumping forward a few years, one of the preeminent San Francisco promoters and impresarios in the 60s and really ever, Bill Graham, ran Fillmore West and East at the time. And he signed you to his label. How did you first link up with Bill Graham?
Well, the first time I met Bill Graham, I was actually, it was right after the Gotham City Crime Fighters. And we went there and auditioned at the original Fillmore on Geary.
Geary, yeah.
And I remember Bill Graham went to my mother and he said, I think you boys need to do another year in the garage. And we did. And then, a few years later, after I got into soul music and started, we had a band called the Motowns. And when I met Doc, we wanted to get into the Fillmore West. And so we knew we'd never get in there wearing suits and being called the Motowns. So we changed the name to Tower of Power and grew our hair long and, started dressing like everybody else was dressing that day during that time. Hippies, And we got an audition at the Fillmore West. And by God's grace, Bill Graham dug us. And he had just started two new record companies. One was distributed through Columbia and the other one distributed through Atlantic. And the one on Atlantic was San Francisco Records. And we signed our first deal with them. And he was partners with a producer named David Rubinson. So David Rubinson and Bill, they saw us audition. And they dug it. And next thing I know, we were signed to an album deal. And, everybody was trying to get on those labels. I mean, everybody in the Bay Area, and people were flying in from Texas, from Chicago, from Florida to try and get on Bill's label. And we were nobody. We were like the little Puddleys, Nobody knew who we were, But we played good soul music. We were good to dance to. And we had these originals that we had written, and they went, yeah, and they signed us.
And you've often said that Oakland is your sound. I mean, what is it about the Bay Area that really contributed to your music and made it what it was?
Well, cities in general when it comes to soul music, they have a sound. New Orleans has a more a loose kind of bump to it, and their singing is much different than, say, Motown or Philly or Chicago or New York. In Oakland, it was a real urban soul sound. And, I don't know if you know this, but Sly Stone was a disc jockey in Oakland, and he was a big influence on us because he was everybody's favorite DJ. I mean, everybody listened to him as a DJ, even people that weren't into soul music, because he was such a personality on the radio. And, You know, he was first on KSOL, K-Soul Radio. Then he was on KDIA. And right about the time that I became a soul band, I saw his band, Sam and Stone, at a local nightclub near my house. And we used to go there, Rocco and I, every weekend. And we, you know, they had a they had a cyclone fence in the back, and there was a swimming pool in there. We used to climb over that fence and go in the back door of the club and sneak in. And we would stay there till like 9 a.m. because at 8 o'clock they served free breakfast. And Sly and the Family Stone, they used to play like, you know, four sets up till 2 a.m. you know, and then take a break. And at 2 a.m. the bar shut down, and they had this law in Hayward, California, and most of the Bay Area, that you couldn't dance and you couldn't drink between 2 a.m. and 6 a.m. So the bands that played what's called after hours, they had to put on a show. You know, they did shtick. You know, they would like do comedy routines, and like Sly and them, they would go down onto the dance floor and do ham bone contests between each other. And they would start a song and everybody would switch over to the next instrument and then play for a while and go to the next until they came all the way around back to their own instrument. You know, stuff like that. You had to do that to play after hours. We wound up being an after hours band for, you know, probably 3 years. I mean, we played after hours a lot. So Sly was a big influence on us. Not that we wanted to be our music to be like his. We wanted our band to be exciting live like he was. He had the energy, and we dug that. And plus, he had Gregor Rico on drums, and that was the first real hip funk drummer that hit the scene. And he was really bringing it, you know. And I started messing with the beat right around then.
Oh, I mean, Sly, it's crazy. I mean, like you said, I mean, what a huge influence in the scene. I mean, not only with the band and as a DJ, but wasn't he was producing bands too. Didn't he produce the initial incarnation of Jefferson Airplane, the Great Society? Didn't he produce some of their early stuff?
I'm not sure about that, but he produced the Bo Brummels.
Yeah, that's right. Laugh, laugh, and yeah.
Just a little, cry just a little. And he also produced Bobby Freeman, Come On and Swim, which was a huge national hit.
That was him? I didn't know that was him.
He used it, and he played the guitar.
Oh, that makes so much sense, because that guitar, I mean, that's a heavy record today. I DJ 45 soul nights and stuff, and I play that all the time.
Great, it's great.
Oh, man. I mean, how tight were you and Tower of Power with San Francisco bands like, you know, the ones I just mentioned, like Jefferson Airplane or Quicksilver Messenger Service? Or like, had they kind of moved on more of the psych people by the time that you guys were really coming into your own?
You know, they had kind of had their run by the time we hit the scene. But over the you know, the years, we became familiar with all of them. Because, you know, the Jefferson Airplane, they kind of, you know, reunited and changed their name to the Starship. And we played on their records. And, you know, Quicksilver Messenger Service, although I didn't know them when, you know, before we got signed to Bill. After we got signed to Bill, and years later, I worked with Huey Lewis in the News, and Mario Cipollino was the bass player, and his brother John was in Quicksilver Messenger Service. And so, and then David Freiberg was the bass player for Quicksilver. He wound up being the bass player for the Starship, you know. So, yeah, I got to know all of them, you know, all the bands in the Bay Area. And it was a great time to be in the Bay Area. I mean, the whole world was looking at the Bay Area.
Yeah, I mean, that was the scene. I mean,
and you know, I give all the credit for that to Bill Graham. I mean, he literally changed the music industry when he started throwing concerts, because he tweaked the collective ear of the Bay Area. And he did it in New York too. And the way he did it was, once he got so popular that his place was the place to be, and that was pretty quickly, he'd have the Grateful Dead, but then he'd have, you know, Howlin' Wolf and Tito Puente, you know, and then the next night he'd have Quicksilver and Miles Davis and Rahsaan Roland Kirk, you know, all these. He would have Sam and Dave and Otis Redding and Janis Joplin, you know, all these really, and everybody, that's when, you know, everybody's getting high, expanding their minds, and all these hippies are out there just going, "Ooh, dude, this is cool," you know, looking at Otis Redding, you know.
Well, and you guys opening for Aretha at, I think it was Fillmore East. What?
Fillmore West.
Oh, was it the West? What was that experience like?
Phenomenal. Phenomenal. We actually played a gig opening for her 1 week earlier, the weekend before that, at the CBS convention in Los Angeles. And Doc always tells this story. You know, we always stood at our microphones and played right in the microphones. You know, we had a big horn section sound. Well, she had the Memphis horns with her. And when she played at the convention, you know, they all sat down and they're reading parts and the mics were like this far away. And they got, we pretty much, I mean, we brought it pretty good at the CBS convention. So when we got to the Fillmore West, we noticed they were all on their mics now. So, you know. And then she had Bernard Purdy playing drums for her. Oh, and, yeah. And, you know, he knew about us and he really dug us. And he used to come, we played this Monday and Tuesday night gig in Jack London Square called the On Broadway. And everybody was coming to sit in. All the guys from Sly, from Cold Blood, Elvin Bishop, Boz Gags, Hugh Masekela used to come, you know, Santana. And Bernard Purdy, when he was in town, he would come down there, you know. So he knew us. And so if you listen to that record, Aretha Live at the Fillmore, on the last night when Ray Charles came to set in on Spirit in the Dark, they took the ride out really long. And at one point, he breaks it down. And Bernard had gotten off the drums. He goes to David Garibaldi, come on, you know. And David plays the ride out after that. And then Bernard's getting so excited because David's grooving. He starts smashing the cymbals on 2 and 4, you know, and you can hear that on the record, you know. It was a great, great, great weekend. I remember also Cold Blood wanted to play, and but Bill decided we were the ones right for the gig, but he let them play on Saturday night. And so I went there, and I'm listening to Cold Blood. And, you know, they had stolen our trumpet player, Mick Gillette. And so he was with them, and but he missed us, and he used to come and sit in with us all the time, even though he was with them. And I remember he came to me and he said, you know, I want to sit in at the Fillmore when we play with Aretha.
Of course you do.
And I said, you know, that wouldn't be right because you're with Cold Blood now, you know, and you're like their secret weapon. It wouldn't be right for me to use them on our set. So I didn't let him sit in with us. And I remember I was backstage listening to them, and they're a great band. They sound wonderful, you know. And I was back there with a couple of the background singers, Sweethearts of Soul. And one of the girls, she's listening. She looks at me and she goes, they're good. I go, yeah, they are. And she goes, they're not as good as you. And I remember also the story I always tell about Aretha. You know, it was a real media event. So they had this backstage dressing room. It was a big room. You know, it was like 3 bedrooms, the size of it, you know, but all open, you know, and we were all in there, you know. But there was so much media and so many, you know, groupies and hangers. Everybody wanted to be in that dressing room. So it was packed, you know, and I couldn't even get in. So I was standing in the doorway. And here comes Aretha. And I'm standing there. And so I turn sideways. And I lean against the door jamb, and she slides in, and she's face to face with me, nose to nose. And she goes, Tower Power, my favorite band. And I just melted. That's one of my most favorite memories of all time.
I would ride that for the rest of my life. Yes, that's amazing. Wow.
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy 1 pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. This week, I'm talking to acclaimed musician and entrepreneur, Mr. Worldwide himself, Pitbull.
A lot of artists in general, people that are very creative, sometimes tend to overthink. That's one of my number one rules. Don't ever overthink. You can think ahead, but don't overthink. And what I mean by that is when they start to write a record, they're like, oh, that's not the line. Oh, that's not this. Oh, it's not that. And everybody has a creative process. I'm not knocking it. For me, I just let it flow.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Snakes, zombies, sharks, heights, speaking in public. The list of fears is endless. But while you're clutching your blanket in the dark, wondering if that sound in the hall was actually a footstep, the real danger is in your hand when you're behind the wheel. And while you might think a great white shark is scary, what's really terrifying and even deadly is distracted driving. Eyes forward, don't drive distracted. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
God, I mean, just so many memories. I mean, you mentioned earlier about sort of making the jump from playing covers to writing your own material. How did that come to pass? How did you start writing your own music?
I give all the credit to Doc. My thing as the band leader of the band called the Motowns was I messed with the beat and I messed with the horn arrangements and I messed with the vocal arrangements. So I would make up these weird beats. We would be doing 99 and a half by Wilson Pickett. But I didn't want to do it with the beat for the record, you know, so I would make up a beat like, and I would teach my brother the beat. You know, we would rehearse and rehearse. And I'd get him the beat, and then I'd make up a bass line. I teach that to Rocco, and I'd find a part on the guitar that, you know, Jody could do that would go in and out, you know, and then I changed the horn parts a little bit, you know, not a lot, but a little bit, you know, and that was what I did. And then one day Doc comes to me after I hired him and he'd been in the band for a little bit and we were sounding good, you know, and he says, you know, what you're doing with these songs is amazing, you know, and he says, but why are we doing them to everybody else's songs? Why don't we write our own? And I always tell people, I don't know that I ever would have thought about that. That thought never occurred to me. I was totally happy doing what I was doing, you know. But I looked at him, I go, we can try that, you know. And so I went over to his apartment, you know, a couple of days later. And first song we wrote, You're Still a Young Man. Still to this day, one of the biggest tunes we ever wrote.
And was that? I had heard a story that was semi-autobiographical. Is that true?
Well, yeah, I was 18 and I had a girlfriend that was 24 years old and she was gorgeous, gorgeous girl. And we had this torrid love affair and she had this ex-boyfriend and she wound up leaving me to go back with the guy. And he was kind of abusive. He was a Vietnam vet and he was kind of abusive, but she had this thing for him. She left me to go back to him and broke my heart. I mean, I was devastated, you know, young, you know. But then she came back to me, you know. When she first broke up with me, she would always say, you know, you need to hang out with girls your own age. You know, I'm too old for you. You know, you're too young to be with a woman my age. And I was like, no. I want to be with you. So when we sat down to write You're Still a Young Man, first we wrote the intro. We had this really great trumpet player, Mick Gillette, and there was this song by The Impressions called My Woman's Love that started with this beautiful intro called, it was a really high trumpet. We loved it, you know. And so the first thing Doc, And me said, we got to write a trumpet intro. So we wrote the intro to He's Still the Young Man. And then I said, so we got to tell a story. Well, how about a guy is, you know, this girl is telling him, you're too young. You know, don't waste your time with me. And the guy is pleading his case. No, no, I'm not too young. I love you, you know. And I was basing it off me and this girl, Sharon Martin. And so, yeah, we just started writing it. You know, down on my knees, heart in hand, I was accused of being too young. But I'm not too young. Can't you understand? I think like a man. You're still a young man. The girls can, you know. Of course, we didn't have no girls, so we sang background.
Did she ever know that that was about her?
No, but she, you know, I told you she came back to me and then broke up with me again. And the second time, I kind of got over it. And then she came back a third time. And by then, we had become, you know, we had some notoriety by then.
Power, power.
She was under the impression that I wrote this other song, Sparkling in the Sand, for her. Because somebody said, I think somebody told her, you know, that song, it's about you and him, you know. But she thought it was this other one, the song with the flute, Sparkling in the Sand, which was another love song. But that wasn't really written for her.
I got to ask about what is hip? What is the genesis of that track? And that's, and probably, I would imagine, the one that gets people on their feet the most at your shows, just because it's such a classic.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely is. You know, we have to play it. We'll get lynched if we don't play What Is Hip. And we generally close the show with it. And it was Doc's. Once again, I give the credit to Doc. You know, he's really lyrically the clever lyricist. I kind of come up with clever lyrics here and there. He sort of lives by them, you know. And he came to me and he said, I want to write a song called What Is Hip? And I go, what is hip? What does that mean? He goes, well, you know, what's hip today, tomorrow will be passé, you know. And I go, oh, okay. And so we decided to write it. And then we invited David Garibaldi to come and join us in the writing process. And mainly Doc and I came up with the chords, and you know, and him and I worked out the lyrics on the verses. But Dave is the one that after we had written it, he was in the rehearsal hall. They used to jam. We would rehearse from 11 to 5, but then these guys from Santana would come over. You know, the bass player, Dougie Rush, he was really good. And him and David would jam. And there was a song called I'm Going Down by Freddie King. And it had this bass line, you know, it was really cool, you know. And so they were jamming on that. And then David, as he's prone to do, he always like, you come up with the beat, then he goes, you know, we could do this, you know. And so he put this hit in there, a 16th before one, bop, you know. And then he added two more, bop, 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 you know. And so he comes in, he says, man, me and Dougie were jamming last night. We were jamming on that groove from I'm Going Down. He goes, you know, maybe we could use that for What Is Hip. And he, you know, they played it for me. And I go, are you kidding? Yeah, that'll work perfect. I sang right over it. It fit perfectly. And then Rocco, of course, on the bass, he took it to another level on the bass.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's like an earthquake. I mean, that's a song you got to listen to on good speakers or something. You got to feel that track.
Yeah.
Oh man, I mean, there's so many things, so many incredible songs. I think I have this right. I would imagine you're one of the few people who's worked with both Quincy Jones and George Martin. I'm hard pressed to name more famous producers in history. What were those experiences like? I mean, George Martin, I'm a huge Beatles fan. I imagine when he was producing America. What was he like in the studio?
Well, we did, what was the Beatles movie?
Sergeant Pepper.
Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, yeah. So they made the movie starring Peter Frampton. And he brought in our horn section and some other horn players. Very good. Chuck Finley, Bill Watrous, you know, and we did like 3 or 4 days of recording, a lot of recording. And he was a perfect gentleman always, but he was very specific about what he wanted, you know, and he had a way of just really respectfully letting you know, no, right here, we need it. Or, you know, want you to check the tuning here or right there. That note's a little short. I need the full length on it. He was very musically very knowledgeable and very specific. And we love that. We don't like it when we're in the, you know, in the studio and a producer goes, you know, I want it to be like, you know, when the rose petal hits the floor and that kind of stuff, you know. That makes no, we like people that talk music, you know, and he's a real musician. And then, you know, we did that and it was great. And then a few years later, he was producing the band America. And he was up at our studio that we recorded at in Sausalito, the record plant. And he called us again. And once again, same thing. Real gentleman, but respectfully very specific about what he wanted. And he just brought it out of him. I mean, you could see why he was such a great producer, you know.
And I mean, Quincy must have been cool for you. I mean, because all those stories about, you know, Sarah Vaughan and the Swingin' Ms. D and folks like that. I mean, folks you grew up with, that must have been a really nice full circle moment for all your influences.
Yeah, we knew Quincy because we toured with him when he had a hit record called Body Heat. And he brought out a really hot band. And he had a trumpet player named Bill Lamb that used to come sit in with us. Him and Mick Gillette together was phenomenal. But he also had this guitar and bass player named Johnson, you know, Lewis Johnson and his brother. And he said, I'm going to do a record on these guys, and I want you guys to be on it, you know, because he really dug us. I mean, every night, you know, we were bringing it, and he just dug the band a lot. So we were all friendly, you know. And sure enough, you know, a few months later, he calls us into the studio in Los Angeles, and you know, we're doing the tracks and they sound great. You know, we're kind of taking a little break and we're complimenting him on it. He goes, this thing's going to go, you know, immediately, you know. And mind you, nobody knew who the Brothers Johnson were. You know, they had done one tour with Quincy Jones. That's it. So, but that's how sure of it he was. And he started talking about all the gold records we have, blah, blah, blah. And we didn't have any gold records, you know. And he goes, what do you mean you don't have any gold records? I go, I don't know. We never got any, you know. And he says, are you kidding me? Warner Brothers didn't send you gold records for the Tower of Power album for Back to Oakland? Are you?
I'm shocked by that.
And I go, no, we never got one. And he goes, well, you're getting one for this one. This is going gold, and you're going to get one. And sure enough, man, a couple months later, delivered to my door, gold record, you know, and I still have it.
Oh, that is a great, that's the one with the Shuggy Otis track, Strawberry Letter 23. Oh, that is a great record.
We actually played on that song, but I don't think he took the horns off of that.
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make Mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. This week, I'm talking to acclaimed musician and entrepreneur, Mr. Worldwide himself, Pitbull.
A lot of artists in general, people that are very creative, sometimes tend to overthink. That's one of my number one rules. Don't ever overthink. You can think ahead, but don't overthink. And what I mean by that is when they start to write a record, they're like, oh, that's not the line. Oh, that's not this. Oh, it's not that. And everybody has a creative process. I'm not knocking it. For me, I just let it flow.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's take a moment to breathe. Deep inhale. Extend your spine. Remain focused on what you're doing. If safe to do so, exhale slowly, leaning to one side. Inhale back to center. If safe to do so, exhale slowly to the opposite side. Find mental health resources at loveyourmindtoday.org. This message is brought to you by the Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the Ed Council.
It's funny, before I knew I was talking to you, I was watching or listening on YouTube to you and the Stones at Candlestick Park in almost exactly 40 years ago in October of 81, doing Satisfaction at the end. It's on YouTube and it just sounded so good. And this is actually before I knew I was talking to you. I just wanted to hear it because it's such a legendary show. What are your memories of that night at Candlestick Park?
I didn't know that was on YouTube. I got to watch that. Yeah, that was phenomenal. You know, Bill Graham was the one that promoted not only that tour, but several of their tours at that time. And he wanted us to play with the Stones. But he came to me and he said, you know, with the Rolling Stones, you can't go to them and say, I would like you to have these guys play with you, you know, because it can't be done. They have to ask you. And he said, so I'm going to make sure that you are in their presence for the next few weeks. And we did a gig with, we were playing with Heart at the time, the horn sections, and they were opening for the Stones, and they did it in Denver. And Bill said, I want you to come to the hospitality suite after the show in the hotel and bring your horns, but don't bring them in. And so we go, okay, and you know, and then we get there, we're in this hospitality suite. I mean, there's fine wines and all this great food, you know, records, super sound system, records are playing. And then before we know it, here comes Mick Jagger. And he comes in and starts talking. And I remember he was really into Prince. Prince had just come up. And we knew who Prince was because he recorded his first record across the hall from us in Sausalito. So he's asking me, do you know Prince? You know, and I'm like, yeah, we do actually. You know, he was across the hall. He actually took our second engineer. and he starts talking about that, and we're getting along, and Bill's over there going, oh, this is going good, you know. And he says, the guys have their horns. He goes, and he tells our roadie was with us. He goes, why don't you go get the horns? Bring them up. You know, I don't know what he's thinking. What are we going to do? Play the horns in the hospitality suite? You know? So he sends my roadie down, and we're all kind of feeling kind of awkward. The next thing we know, Mick sort of stops talking, and he turns around, and he kind of dances out of the room backwards, and he was gone. And Bill goes, ah, I messed up. I shouldn't have done that. You know, we're like, what? What happened? And he goes, that didn't feel right to him. You know, so when I said to get the horns, that was wrong. I shouldn't have done it. And so then he flew me to San Diego, to Los Angeles, and then finally, and I'm hanging out, you know, where the Rolling Stones are, you know, and they're completely ignoring me. You know, social person in terms of, you know, hey man, let's party, you know, kind of thing. I'm just hanging out, you know. And of course, so they're, you know, because what he told me was, he says, you have to understand, think if you were like, you know, your face was the most recognizable face in the entire world, because that's what these guys deal with on a daily basis. And he goes, so it has to be their idea and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, yeah, whatever. And so I'm, you know, Denver, San Diego, Los Angeles. Finally, we get to the Bay Area and, you know, I'm tired. I've been hanging out. Nobody's asking me to do nothing. I don't know. So, you know, I'm kind of burnt out. And then, but I go to Candlestick Park and Bill's like, you know, and he has a talk with Mick Jagger. He goes, look, you know, don't you get it? I keep putting this guy in your presence because I want the horns to play with you. They're the greatest horn section in the world, you know? And Mick goes, well, yeah, certainly, you know. And so we're supposed to play Satisfaction. And this is the first night. And Keith Richards wasn't there. And finally he shows up late and he's sick, probably dope sick, you know, and doesn't feel good. And he comes in and we're in there, getting ready. And he's, what's this? You know, and Mick goes, oh, Top, how hard are going to play with this? He goes, not tonight. And they canceled us. And that was it for me. That was the start of the book camp. I said, I'm out of here, you know. And but Doc and Keith Richards, they got along pretty good. And Doc was devastated because we were ready to go on, you know. And so after the show, Bill Graham goes up to Keith Richards because he knows that he likes Doc. And he goes, man, I can't believe you did that. You know, and Keith goes, what? And he says, you devastated that poor guy. He goes, who? You know, he goes, Doc. He goes, they were going to play, man. It's a big deal, you know. He goes, well, we'll do it tomorrow, you know. And so I wasn't there. I had gone home and I was staying with my father-in-law. And by then I'm trash, man. I'm done. And I woke up the next morning. I remember my father-in-law going, aren't you going to the stadium? I said, no, heck with that, man. I'm done. You know, he goes, I think you should go. And so, you know, got a cab, went there. And when I drive up in the cab, Bill Graham is in there out in the parking lot waiting for me. He goes, get in there. They're rehearsing. And I go into this trailer and the guys all got their horns out. And I'm getting my horn out. And Keith Richards looks at me and he goes, we're doing Satisfaction. Do you know the Otis Redding parts? You know, I go, yeah, I think so. You know, we played that song a million times, right? And so we start working it up and they like it. So it's all arranged. We're going to go on for the encore. So they play their set and they have a little rolling riser with five mics for us. And we're behind this scrim, you know, where you can't see us, but we can sort of see through it to the stage. And they're killing it, you know. And then the set ends and they come off and we're getting all ready. And Keith Richards goes on to our riser and passes out. And the next thing I know, Bill Graham's on top of him and he's punching him in the heart and he's giving him mouth to mouth. And he is not coming to. And I'm like, I can't even believe this. After all this, this guy's going to OD and die right here. You know? And the next thing I know, this guy comes up with this black bag. It's obviously their doctor and shoots him up with something. And Keith Richards jumps up. He goes, let's rock! And runs out. And they start Satisfaction, you know. And then as soon as the beat kicks in, we start going, ba 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 da da ba da 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 da, you know, we're nailing it, man. And I remember that we got to the ride out, and Mick Jagger is loving it. And he keeps looking at us, and they're going and going. So he's stretching out the ride out. Well, you know, in a soul band, you know, when the ride-out's really kicking, the lead trumpet player takes it up an octave. So Mick Gillette, and he had great range, you know. Boom, he takes it up. He's blowing. And, you know, and Mick Gillette's loving it. I mean, Mick Jagger's loving it more and more and more. So he's making it go longer and longer. Meanwhile, Mick's face is getting redder and redder, you know. But he's making every note. He's burning it. And then finally he ends the tune. We hit the last chord, and Mick Jagger goes, tap our horns! And we're in San Francisco. You know, they knew us. The place goes berserk, you know. And Bill Graham jumps on my back. He's going, you guys are the greatest horns in the world! He's going crazy. It was a most incredible moment, man. The adrenaline was unbelievable.
Oh, my goodness. I can only imagine. I mean, one of my questions was going to ask you, is there a moment of all the places you play, people you played with, if there's one that stands out? But I imagine that's probably number one on the list, if I were to guess.
I had a lot of good moments, but that was one of the best.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, such an incredible career. I mean, and just your sound is so, I mean, it's so distinct. It's so you. I mean, you've never, it's never had the change because it's perfect in my opinion. I mean, I wanted to ask you, I mean, I know you get asked to play so many session dates with so many different bands. And I know that a crucial component of your sort of agreeing to do it is to use your own arranger. And I wanted to ask you more about that. Like, how does that factor into, as somebody who loves music like I do, but and messes around on instruments, but is not a dyed-in-the-wool musician, would never call myself that. I want to know more about the kind of role that your arranger plays in helping craft your sound as a band.
It's really integral when you're doing session work for other artists that you have in mind the fact that it's about the artist. It's not about your horns or your arrangement. It's about the artist. So whatever you put on that recording needs to not get in the way. You know, whatever the hook of the song is, you can't step on it with the horn parts. If there's an incredible lead vocalist, you don't step all over that vocal with your horn parts. You know, if there's all these rock and roll bands have these, you don't step on that with horns, because when you go to mix, you know, you're trying to get the horns to stand out, but the guitar, who is the main guy in the band, is going, so you got to make sure he's heard. And once you do, you can't hear the horns at all. So you have to pick your spots really carefully. And we had our horn arranger was Greg Adams for about 25 years. And he got that way of arranging down to a science. You know, he wrote really sparse arrangements when we did rock and roll bands, you know. But when we played, it was during the whole, you know, maybe right on the one, bow, or, you know, whatever it was in the whole. And they could mix it really loud without covering up all the stars of the show, you know. And that's really the key. And what I find is when I don't insist on having our arranger, we get hooked up with other people that don't realize that. And for some reason, people seem to think that, especially rock and roll people, they seem to think if you got saxes, well, you want to play low fifths, you know. But as I said, you got three guitar players doing that, you know. So why would you do that, you know? And we had that that situation happen on an Aerosmith record, Just Push Play. If you listen to that recording, the song that we're on, it's non-existent, you know. And that's because they insisted on using this arranger. I remember I told them, I said, you know, it really works better if we do the arrangement. No. Our friend does it. You know, he's arranged for Barbara Streisand. He's really a musician, blah, blah, blah. I go, okay, what am I going to do? Tell him, no, it's an Aerosmith, you know. And, but, you know, the arrangement just, it wasn't the type of arrangement that we do. And so when they went to mix it, they couldn't really bring it up, you know. It's as though we're not on the record. So we get the credit. You know, you read the back of the album, Tower Power Horns, you're like, great, where are they, you know?
How about you, when you're writing, is this something that you do every day, or is it something that really you have to be moved to do?
Doc writes every day. Doc carries a notebook with him. He's very passionate about writing. I've always, and it's interesting because, you know, I really make most of my money from my writing, you know, but I put very little time into it. But, you know, like we had the pandemic, and I make appointments with people, you know. I have a few people I write with, and sometimes I want to write with somebody new. And I'll just say, you know, how you doing Tuesday at 11? You know, show up and we write a song. In the old days, you know, me and Doc lived together, and, you know, there's a lot of drug and alcohol use. So, you know, we'd partying and getting high. It's like, yeah, let's write. We'd start to write, you know. But, you know, now everybody's sober, you know, we all got families, we all got homes. And so we make appointments, you know, we show up, and we always pray first. You know, that's the first thing we do. And then we talk a little bit, you know, what's going on, you know, and just kind of talk. And then if anybody's got a particular idea, I might have a rhythm idea or a hook. Doc might have a lyrical idea. You know, I might have a chord progression, or I'll just sort of start noodling around and go, oh, that's cool. You know, and it's like fishing, you know, once you get a bite, then you reel it in. You know, if it's the hook, then you want to write a story in the first verse that leads to it. And then after the first hook, you want to develop that story further in the second verse. And then, you know, maybe you do the hook again, or maybe you take a left turn to do what's called a bridge. You know, and a bridge could be a musical bridge. It could be a lyrical bridge. It could change chords completely, or it could be the same chords, but put a little guitar thing over it, you know, but something that separates, that does sort of a left turn, and then back to the hook, or maybe half of a verse where you develop the story a little more even, maybe with a little extension on it, go to the hook, and then build the ride up.
This is probably a loaded question, but do you think that songwriting is something that anyone can do, or is it something that you kind of have to be born with in some ways?
Well, I don't know that you have to be born with it, but no, it's not something that anybody can do.
That's what I feel a little better, because I've played a number of instruments since I was a young teenager, and I've never been able to write a song my whole life. Try as I might, it's never been something that...
It helps me to write with people. I don't write alone. Although, during the pandemic, I wrote a few songs by myself, and that was the first. But I think I like to bounce off of people, you know. To me, it's just easier.
Well, that was what I was going to ask you. Are these songs that you've been working on during the pandemic, are they? Is there a new album on the way? Or,
well, I want to do. You know, the last time we recorded, besides the live thing, we did two albums: Soul Side of Town, and then one came out called Step Up during the pandemic. And we recorded all that material at once. So I worked on it for like many years, you know, and it was 28 songs, you know. So that's a big project, but it really paid off, you know, and it had a cohesiveness. We had two really great products with some bonus tracks that we could use for Japan or Europe. It just worked out really well. So I'd like to do the same thing, record two albums. And I want to record a Christian album. You know, I became a Christian in 2004. And as a Christian, I started listening to gospel praise music. And it's my opinion that all the great soul singers are in the church. I'm a huge fan of Yolanda Adams, Dietrich Haddon. I just love all these gospel praise singers. And their productions, really contemporary, you know. Fred Hammond. Yeah, you know. And so I want to do a Christian album and a secular album. But I want to record them all at once.
Oh, that'd be really cool.
So that's the plan right now, tentative, you know. But meanwhile, everybody's writing. I've written a bunch. Doc's always writing. The guys write. And when it's time to make the record, we'll listen to everything, choose some songs, and get them done.
I know you just got off the road, I think a matter of days ago, but any plans for heading back out there soon?
We're not a band that says, I'm going on tour, and then you're off for a few months. We just go in and out all the time. So we did our first gig at the Hollywood Bowl on August 8th, and then we flew cross country. We had a couple of days off. We flew cross country, and we did a little East Coast, Northeast run. And then we came back, and then we went to the Bay Area, did some dates, came back. You know, so we do these little, you know, sometimes they're 3 weeks, sometimes they're 5 days, sometimes it's a weekend. You know, right now I don't have a gig for almost 3 weeks, and then I go out for, I think, 6 dates. And that's how we do it. We're just always in and out. And it's usually 200 days a year we're away from home. And, you know, that's not all gigs. It's travel days and days off on the road. But at least 170 gigs, probably.
Wow.
150, I'm bad with that stuff.
Still loving it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh. Yeah, people, you know, I'm also in the recovery community, you know, so a lot of these people, the meetings that I attend, they know what I do now, you know, and they're always like, so how'd it feel? Feel good to get back? Yes. It feels really comfortable. It feels great. We got back together. We did the Hollywood Bowl, then we went up to the East Coast, and we located ourselves in Boston. We went up to New Hampshire, did two gigs in Boston, then went down towards Virginia. And I think it was about 3 days in, we were all hanging out, and Garibaldi goes, man, he goes, it's amazing how the way it comes back so quick, you know. And we had rehearsed a couple of days, you know, but it just, right now, it just feels so in the pocket. And, you know, I have a great group of guys. I mean, we are truly friends and brothers, and we support each other, and we miss each other, you know. So it's always great to get back out there and be with them. Got a great crew. I have great management. After all these years, you know, I've learned how to hire well.
Could say that again. Absolutely. Oh, Emilio, thank you so much. I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but it has been such a joy and a pleasure talking to you. I really, and an honor, I hasten to add. Thank you so much for your time today and your music. It really means a lot to me. Thank you.
Jordan, it's my pleasure.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Inside the Studio, a production of iHeartRadio. For more episodes of Inside the Studio or other fantastic shows, check out the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Listen to the highly anticipated 100th episode of Tank and Jay Valentine's R&B Money Podcast with artist Chris Brown.
Even working with you from Carrie Hilson, Adonis, back in the day, I was 15, 14 doing that album. So like I said, I was in school. Like,
yeah.
Okay, this is how you do it. This is how you make a song. There's a verse, a pre-chorus, and then a hook. I didn't know none of that.
You learned that over a summer, bro.
That's what it felt like.
That's what it felt like.
Listen to R&B Money on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Check the back seat. Check the back seat.
All right, come here.
Check the back seat.
Gets in your head, right? Good. Because every year, dozens of children are forgotten in the backseat of a car by a parent or caregiver. All never thought it could happen to them. But with changes in routines, distractions, or a sleeping child, it can happen to anyone. Parked cars get hot, fast, and can be deadly. So get it in your head.
Check the back seat.
A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
The biggest stars in country music will be taking the stage at our 2024 iHeart Country Festival, presented by Capital One.
iHeart Country.
Jason Aldean. Keith Urban. Jelly Roll. Old Dominion. Lady A. Riley Green. Ashley McBride. Brothers Osborne. Walker Hayes. All hosted by Bobby Bones at Austin's Moody Center. Saturday, May 4th. Stream only on Hulu. Starting at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific.